This is Bill Decker for the Clean Energy Solutions Center, and I'm talking in Rome today with Olivia Dubois, who is a Senior Natural Resources Officer for the Climate, Energy, and Tenure Division at the Natural Resources Management and Environment Department at the United Nations here in Rome. Mr. Dubois, thank you very much for taking the time. You have spent much of your life working in 40 different countries, as I understand it, on agricultural, rural development, food issues. And, of course, those are very, very important today. As we know from a few years ago when food prices were affected by the energy versus fuel conflict in some countries. So tell us a little bit about your work, first of all, and then a little bit about some of the, what you believe are the cutting leading issues right now in food production around the world.
Yeah. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Starting from maybe some global issues. I mean, the world is faced with a huge challenge, in that I think it's the first time in human history where simultaneously we will have to address in the next decades huge and simultaneous increases in water needs, in energy needs, and in food needs, and so I think this is I mean a huge challenge, and it happens also in the context where there's significant, the natural resources are stressed, basically. There's a lot of natural resources degradation and so on. And to add to that, the complicating factor is obviously climate change and all the possible implications on energy options, on food production and water needs and availability. So, I mean, that's, I think, is the basic premise that's led FAO to really strengthen its program on energy in agriculture, because how this nexus would translate in the development of agri-food chains. I mean, we did an overview on the energy used in the agri-food chain, but also interestingly, the agri-food chain can produce energy. And so we found out, for example, that globally, I mean, the agri-food chain uses about 30% of the available energy. I'm not talking about the primary energy, but the available energy, end-use energy. And this was a surprise, I think, to us, but to many people outside. And it was not accounted for before, because the energy along the agri-food chain is accounted in agriculture before the farm gate, but then it's in industry, manufacturing sectors, and so we put these figures together and found that. So the agri-food chain is a significant user of energy. It's obviously a significant user of water too, and so I mean we also found out that most of this energy is actually used beyond the farm gate, about 70%, and so. In terms of climate change and costs and all of that and availability of energy, the stages beyond the farm gate matter a lot too, which was again something which was not very clear beforehand. And the third really striking finding is that, you know, FAO did a study a couple of years ago which found that globally 30% of the food we produce is basically lost or wasted. And in terms of energy, this translates into about 38% of the energy used in the agri-food chain is just basically lost. Mm. So when you put that together, you say, well, we need to do something about this. Because, I mean, and one key challenge is the fact that conventional development of agri-food chains is very dependent on fossil fuels. This has done wonders in terms of reducing hunger before, increasing yields and all of that, but now we need to think differently, because of climate change issues, and also because fossil fuels, in general, their costs are likely to increase, and so this has implications in terms of input costs for agriculture, and ultimately on food prices. So I mean, all that means that FAO, we've boosted our work on energy and links to agriculture with a program that we call, let's say, Energy Smart Food for People and Climate, which basically aims to, has to, let's say, three objectives. One is to improve energy efficiency along agri-food chains. The second one is to diversify the energy mix by increasing gradually the use of renewable energy in agri-food chains, but also ultimately to improve access to modern energy in agri-food chains.
Before we go further, let me make sure everyone understands that when you say FAO, you're talking about the Food and Agriculture Organization within the United Nations,
yes,
which is where you work. Before we began taping, we talked a little bit about the energy, water, food nexus, as it's being called. You've touched upon that, but let's dig a little deeper into that because it's a very important issue, I know, in the United States and elsewhere. For example, our energy choices, it's quite likely in the future, will be affected by our water supplies because many fossil energy resources use a lot of water, either in cooling power plants or in the extraction process itself. Are you working in this nexus, and what are we finding about the relationship between water, energy, and food?
I think there's, because of the challenge I was mentioning before, and somebody called it like the perfect ingredients, the ingredients for a perfect storm, if you include also climate change issues, then there's an increased awareness of the linkages between water, energy, and food / land use. What we need to do now is to do something about it. And this is where the difficulty starts, because automatically, beyond the awareness raising, you need to organize sectors that often do not work together. And so from a practical point of view, you need first to improve the knowledge, the awareness, primarily, I think, through examples where, for example, you show that by not looking at things through a nexus perspective, you may do things wrong or you may miss opportunities. And we have examples where if you do the right things, then it, through the nexus approach, then it helps. One example I have in mind is in India, for example. In India, before, the energy for irrigation was for free. And one implication of you had probably a lot of wasted water, but you also had like a underground black market where the people who had access to water could, and or energy for water, could basically sell it to poorer farmers who didn't have that access. And more or less it was working. The access to energy was there. Now it's everything is metered, so you have to pay for your energy. As a result, this system, this informal system, doesn't work that well. So a big question is, what should we do in terms of energy? But that just looks at one aspect of things. Obviously, you have to do things on the energy side, but you can also do something on the water side. For example, reducing leakages in along the water pipes, or improving the water efficiency. But there again, if you do drip irrigation, it's more water efficient, but you need energy, which for gravity irrigation you don't need, for example. So again, you have to find trade-offs there. You can also develop more drought-tolerant crops and use them. So these kind of things are a perfect illustration of if you address things sectorally, you may miss some issues, but you may miss some solutions too. And this is where the interdependency between these three factors or sectors calls for a nexus approach.
So the message for policymakers around the world is a holistic approach or a nexus approach to policy on energy, water, or food. There's an interesting study that came out, I think you're aware, in 2009, which said that we have a carbon budget now, and that in order to stay at 2 degrees or less of global warming above industrial levels, we need to pay attention to that budget. And we have about 11 years left of that budget with current fossil energy use. And then the International Energy Agency came out and translated that to say about 2/3 of the fossil energy, the proven fossil energy reserves in the world, have to stay in the ground. And I can imagine this would have a big impact on agriculture, too, so long as it's dependent on fossil energy, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is the so-called unburned, you know, carbon, which is there, but can we use it if we take into account the requirements to let's say, to protect ourselves from the impact of climate change and to reduce climate change.
Realizing, I think, in the United States that water supplies are going to affect our energy choices also. We're going to have to probably choose those that have less water consumption, especially in areas that are being affected by climate change and drought. Let's turn to a subject I know that you know so well, and that is the so-called food versus fuel conflict. The idea that if we produce biofuels, dedicated crops for biofuels, we're taking away farmland, taking away food production. What has your work found in this area?
Yes, obviously this work is part of a big component of our work, which is basically sustainable bioenergy. And biofuels, which is like the liquid fuels produced out of biomass, are part of that. But this conflict, possible conflict, is really something that motivated us to devote a lot of our own energy and work to this topic in the last few years. And the first thing that we need to note is that this is a extremely complex and multifaceted topic. And it occurs at different levels. And also, the implications on the short term are different than those on the longer term, and it affects different people in different ways. So when you take all that into account, we think basically that the first key message that we have is that you need to have evidence-based work to inform policy making and practitioners, because sweeping statements hardly hold. I mean, it's so context specific, the issues and the solutions, that on the one hand you have a lot of studies that start from, because it's complex, they do modeling, which is great. I mean, modeling has a role, but we should not exaggerate and overstate the roles of modeling. It gives you some scenarios and the flavor of what might happen in the future. But when it comes to what happens in the field, which is the short-term thing that we need to address right now, you obviously need to complement that primarily now if you base your judgment on evidence, what happens on the ground, on statistics going to the field and what happens on the local level. And so just to give you one example of that we found out is that there is something in agriculture called rotations, you know, where you'd grow one crop and then you grow the other one. And this leads to what we call multiple cropping, is the use of the same piece of land for several times over the year. And this, for example, obviously increases the possibility to grow crops on the same piece of land. This aspect of multiple cropping cannot be captured, for example, by models. And so you miss there a crucial factor that may lead you to assess the fact that maybe you don't need that much additional land for agriculture, but also for food-based biofuels, for example. Mm. This is just one aspect. So, and also, the models, obviously, they come up with all sorts of assumptions, and therefore you have all sorts of results. I mean, the results in terms of the possible impact of biofuels on food prices, for example, it ranges from 5 to 70% or 80%, because the models give you different results. And also something that often is not taken into account is that these studies concern global prices, global food commodity prices. And they very seldom look at how these transmit to national levels and local levels, household levels. And this obviously is crucial. That's why things matter. So the price transmission factor is often ignored. And the transmission of international prices to national and local prices depend on all sorts of factors. It can be weather, the degree of self-sufficiency of countries, currency exchange, all sorts of things that have nothing to do with biofuels. Mm. So this, again, it adds to our argument that these studies are fine, but you really need a lot of evidence-based arguments to come up with policy recommendations and recommendations to operators and investors. So FAO, on that basis, we took a different stance compared to others. We really started our work on bioenergy and food security based, our work is based on country work, basically, country evidence and all of that. So we developed, the bulk of our work is what we call the bioenergy and food security approach. And it started by looking at the links between bioenergy and food security in three countries, which have very different circumstances. Thailand, quite advanced for a developing country, let's say, in between like emerging economy and developing country. Then Tanzania, which is kind of least developed countries, part of the least developed countries, and something in between, which is Peru. So again, a diversity of circumstances, of development stages, but also geographic differences. And this is what led us basically to come up with some interesting findings. For example, the finding, a very important one, which is a sweeping statement, but we can substantiate, is that there's no good or bad biofuels. It depends on how you manage them. How does that translate, for example, is that having food-based feedstock for biofuels does not necessarily mean competition with food. For example, if you increase significantly the yields of food crops, then you can combine production of biofuels and food. If you take the example of Brazil, over the last 30 years, the yields of sugarcane have significantly increased. I mean, it's just amazing, the increases in yields in sugarcane. And the main incentive has been the development of sugarcane ethanol. Not so much the sugar, because the sugar consumption maybe has increased, but not to the extent of justifying such a big program and such increases in yields in sugarcane. I think, for example, in the US, the increases in corn yields have also significantly increased, partly through the incentive caused by corn ethanol, for example. So you can do that. And we have an example, actually, in developing countries. The study, when we started our work in Tanzania, the government asked us, can you please look at what's going on with the cassava commodity chain? And we frowned. We said, but this is a food crop. And they told us precisely. Because if really the interest in biofuel generates investments and research and development, then part of it will lead to yields. It will yield increase, and again, it can be used for food and to feed our people and also to produce biofuels. And so you have the example of sugarcane, you have the example of corn, you have an example from developing countries. And then the government told us, well, we have a counterexample where an energy crop, like jatropha, for example, we really want you to have a short view on, just a little study on that, because we are not convinced that automatically energy crops lead to non-competition with food. Because obviously it can compete indirectly because it uses land. And they had examples from the next door country, Kenya, where at some stage there was some incentives for our small-scale farmers to plant jatropha. And then the buying company pulled out because of the economic crisis. The farmers were left without any market for the jatropha seeds. But it was competing for land. So they didn't have food. Well, they had less food, and they didn't have the income. So the Tanzanian government learned from that and said, well, you know, can we go for that? So for us, this is a major finding. And if you take that now to another topic, which is what we call the second generation biofuels, which is basically non-food feedstock, we also say we need to be cautious about this, because it's not because you use energy crops that you will not compete with food, for the reasons that I just told you, Geotrophy is one, but even planting trees may compete with food. And even the use of residues, which is sometimes heralded as the solution, you know, the win-win solution, FAO says caution on this because residues are becoming a commodity. And people, you know, may say, well, let's use the residues from the agri-food chain, from agriculture and processing, just to produce energy. But in many cases, it's already used for agriculture, to fertilize soils, to protect soils, mulching. But also it's used very often to feed animals in developing countries, especially in, you know, small-scale livestock systems. A colleague of mine from the livestock division has done some questionnaires, for example, in India, and it came out that about 30 to 40% of the food for animals in India, or for livestock, comes from agriculture residues. So if you use that for bioenergy, for biofuels, then you have a problem. You have to grow more food to feed animals. So that's again, an example of the nexus, you see, between energy production and agriculture in this case.
I want to lead you away from rural areas for a second, yeah. Perhaps outside your comfort zone, but of course, we're seeing massive urbanization around the world, and I wonder what the potential for urban organic wastes is in the biofuels arena.
I think organic wastes in general have a huge potential. In urban centers, the big advantage there is that you have a concentration of urban waste. The challenge there is the whole logistics. Is to gather these wastes, is to organize that, you know, in communities, in neighborhoods, and all of that, and then bring it to one place where it can work. I have one example from the periphery of Ho Chi Minh, where I was a couple of years ago, where you have farmers collecting leftovers from restaurants. And then it was very interesting. They were using that to feed pigs. But using the leftovers raw, some pigs became sick. So they decided to cook the leftovers from the restaurants, the raw stuff. And they use wood energy. So they get residues from carpentries and small sawmills nearby, and they cook food for pigs. I've never seen happier pigs, I can tell you. I mean, these pigs were having cooked meals. But again, I mean, this is an opportunity because otherwise the restaurants would dump, you know, the leftovers, or you can see in some places in the developing world piles of residues somewhere being burnt. Mm-hmm. Which is not good for climate change, it's not good for anything. And so there's a huge opportunity there. The issue there, I think, is to really first sensitize those who produce the and then organize, making it a business. You know, the restaurants, in this case, they were happy to give it away. In some places, you can have a tax if you dump your residue. So you need policies to incentivize the use of the leftovers and organic waste from, but there is a lot of future there, I think.
Well, it sounds to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the lessons for policymakers in our conversation today is, number one, to be holistic in your approach, understand mm-hmm. the nexus between water, energy, food, and probably in climate change and other factors as well. And secondly, that the food versus fuel debate needs to be very location-specific, crop-specific, yeah. Water-specific, climate-specific, that the generalities may be informative, but not to the point of shaping a particular country's policies. Did I get that right?
Yeah, there's a third message, which for us is very important, is that, you know, when the boom on biofuels started, let's say, early 2000s, people went into that, you know, without really knowing the implications. Let's be honest with ourselves here, because, and there were no tools on how to assess that. And since then, I think let's say, for example, at FAO, we've developed what we call a sustainable bioenergy support package, which is not just about liquid biofuels or biofuels, but it's about bioenergy in general. But obviously it includes biofuels, and it applies particularly to this food versus fuel, trying to say, well, now there are tools that can help move or ensure that we are not competing, there's no competition, and we can produce food and fuel. And we have developed kind of this toolkit, which has different tools for different needs and different circumstances. For example, we have tools that help you carry out a situation analysis. And you can do that on a detailed level per commodity. But you can, we've just finished now what we call the Bioenergy and Food Security Rapid Appraisal tool, which helps governments have an idea within 3 or 4 months on the potential for sustainable bioenergy production, which does not compete with food. And it has to do with the potential of biomass, the biomass potential, but also some aspects concerning technologies and obviously the possible implications for households. So this is something that helps governments getting things right. And you can start with your rapid appraisal, and then once you identify the options, the best bet options, put it this way, then you can say, well, let's do a detailed study on that commodity, maybe sugarcane ethanol, maybe palm oil, biodiesel, for example, or biogas. And so that's, but many countries, they tell us, well, we don't have time to do that. We have investors knocking at our doors. They want to invest. They tell us, give us that piece of land, that piece of land. We, you know. So what do we do? And so for those who do not have time to carry even a rapid appraisal, then we tell them, well, we have a compilation of good practices, which are known. I mean, there's no rocket science here. And the advantage is now we have compiled those. And so we have socioeconomic good practices and also environmental good practices. And we also have some recommendations in terms of the policies to promote these good practices. Examples of good practices include, you know, agroecological zoning, defining where to grow your biofuel feedstock. Another one is, obviously, agroecological practices to increase yields, conservation agriculture, for example, practices. Other ones, conservation agriculture, when you have industrial agriculture, you can call it also precision agriculture, is doing more with less, for example. Another one is something we've worked quite a lot, is what we call integrated food energy systems, whereby on the same piece of land, you combine the production of energy and food. You can do it in two ways. One is producing, growing energy crops and food crops side by side through agroforestry systems, for example. You can have your jatropha to produce the energy intercropped with food crops. And this happens in West Africa in many places. And the second type of integrated food energy system is one like a cascading system where you use the byproducts of one type of production to produce the other one. Classical example is biogas. You know, the manure from the livestock, you can use it to produce biogas. Another example is animal feed products from corn ethanol. So there you use byproducts from food to produce energy. You can also use byproducts of energy to produce food. For example, you can use the leftover from producing sugarcane, which is the bagasse, to produce electricity with which you can run your farm, basically. So I mean it's an area of work that we are really emphasizing a lot, is this combined production of energy and food, because it's the epitome of the argument that you can do food and fuel.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned some of the tools that you've developed, and you anticipated my last question, and that is, where can policymakers find access to the tools and the information and the knowledge you've developed in this program?
Yeah. Just before I go to that, I want to mention one last set of tools, because I mentioned like examples of good practices, but then obviously you need tools to monitor and evaluate the performance of bioenergy and biofuels in particular. And for that, we have tools that can work at operator level. So very important for investors and banks that want to support investments in biofuels. So we have an operator level tool that it's like a scorecard that gives you an idea of where you stand in terms of potential risks concerning food security of your investment. You can also use it to monitor once you've done it. And we have also, FAO is part of the Global Bioenergy Partnership, which is a very interesting partnership because it's probably the only bioenergy partnership which includes like 40 countries. And the big players in biofuels, you know, US, Europe, Malaysia, Indonesia, Brazil, obviously, Argentina, Colombia, are part of the GBEP, the Global Bioenergy Partnership. And together with the other partners, FAO has developed, we have contributed to the development of GBEP sustainable bioenergy indicators, which basically helps countries report on the performance of the sector at national level. Hmm. So again, this is the last set of tools. So the key message concerning tools is that we are not where we were 5 or 6 years ago, where we didn't really know the implications. We didn't have the tools to assess where we're going and the possible impacts. Now we have that. So basically no excuse for governments and operators to say, well, we didn't know. And FAO has a website with all these tools available. So you can access these tools. It's public domain. There's no problem with that. And we already have governments interested in that.
What is that web address?
Oh, the web address, it's FAO home, and then you go to the Natural Resources Department, and you go to Energy, and you find we have a summary of our toolkit on sustainable bioenergy.
Very good. Find it there. And I'll include that web address, too, in the caption to this podcast.
Yeah.
One closing thought. I'm thinking back to the first point we discussed about a holistic approach to bioenergy production. And that is the amount of water used, the amount of energy used in processing, all yep. affect the net carbon impact and the net energy and the net water impact of a biofuel. So policymakers need to look at that as well, don't they? How they process the food, how they grow it, yep. all the resources that go into it, and do kind of a full cost analysis to make sure that there's a net benefit for the environment and yep. so on. Yep.
I mean, this is part of a big piece of work that FAO has been involved in, which is called Climate Smart Agriculture, which obviously includes how to be smart in terms of water use, how to be smart in terms of energy use, and getting energy from the agri-food sector. So these, and now we've just finished Climate Smart Agriculture source book, and so there's a big interest in how to make, let's say, the agri-food systems smart in terms of climate change. Mm. And so this is, I think, very, very, very important, I think. And again, it calls for a holistic approach to that. But that there's a lot of things available. That's, I think, a key message, I mean. And there's a lot of good practices available. So, yes, the topics are complex, but we can start doing the right things. I think this is a key message from FAO. Very often, as you rightly said at the end of our interview, is that where can people find that? Well, now it is available. I mean, and FAO is not the only organization working on this, but being given FAO's mandate and the expertise that we have on all these aspects, obviously it's a key mandate for FAO to enhance the knowledge on complex topics and relatively new topics such as the nexus, such as climate change, but also to show that we can help. And so I think this is a key message that I would finish. It's like an optimistic note. Yes, it is a huge challenge, but there are ways that already exist to help move in the right direction.
Well, Mr. Dubois, thank you very much for sharing your time, but more importantly, your knowledge of this very important topic.
Yeah.
We appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and I mean, we are available. If you, some of your listeners want to contact us, I mean, you have the website of FAO, you have you mentioned my contact. We are available, basically.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.